Hi, I want to welcome everyone to our class here. This is part two of the Persuasion class of the Spiritual Recovery Series in the Barnabas Ministry. And in the first part of this class, we talked about techniques of persuasion that are used by what we could call compliance professionals, and also talked about groups and how groups influence our behavior, get us to do things. And so we want to pick up that same theme, and there's two more areas we want to talk about. And we're going to talk about authority and persuasion, and we're going to talk about thought reform environments and what they are, how they work, and things like that. So let's go ahead and jump into that. Now, dealing with the question of authority and persuasion, again, this is one of the areas that Cialdini used identified as one of the themes, and he was referring to it more as expertise or just generic sorts of authority. But when you get into a church setting, of course, there are legitimate authorities in the church, in leadership, with elders and things like that. And so this question really merits a lot of consideration. But authority can be used the right way and the wrong way. And let me tell you about some research that was done one time. There was a psychologist named Stanley Milgram. And he, if you look on the website, you'll see an article called The Perils of Obedience. Let me summarize what his experiment was and draw some examples or draw some conclusions from that about how that might affect the church. He set up an experiment that pitted authority against people's moral imperatives against hurting other people. And what the experiment was is that, and everybody was in on it except one person. And the person would sit in a room with a little buzzer, and they would be instructed when to push with a little button. Every time they would push the button, it would shock somebody that was in another room that they could see through glass. And this person was being trained to do some things, supposedly. And the person running the experiment would tell the subject when to push the button to cause pain to this person. And they could also change a dial on this contraption that would supposedly increase the electrical shock that the person was getting. And, of course, the shock wasn't real. It was all acted. But as far as the person doing the experiment was concerned, it was real. And so they would go through these exercises of the person doing something, and they wouldn't conform or they wouldn't get something right, and the instructor would tell the subject, go ahead and push the button, zap them. And you'd zap them, and they'd see the person kind of jump and convulse a little bit. And as they would go through the experiment, the power might get cranked up, and the person would go through a more extensive negative experience to be shocked. And what Milgram found was that people would push the button when someone told them to do it and took responsibility for what was going on. The people might complain, oh, look at it, this guy's in massive pain. And the experimenter would say, it's okay, I'll take responsibility for that. Go ahead and do it. So the guy would say, okay, and push the button and zap the guy. And the thing that's really interesting about that is it shows us that people will do what authority tells them to do, even if it looks like it's a bad thing, or even if it looks like it's causing great harm to people. And it's really a stunning thing. And they were stunned by those findings to the point where they said, well, is there a cultural aspect to this? Is there something with age? They ran this experiment in various other countries with different age groups of people and things like that. And they found that regardless of those factors, people would go ahead and hurt others because someone told them to do it. And it's really quite a stunning finding. Well, a thing that this experiment really shows us is that people will do anything practically that someone tells them to do. And authority is a very, very powerful concept, and it needs to be used very carefully. Now, the thing about dealing with authority from the subject perspective is that, you know, we're still responsible for what we do. We just can't pass responsibility off on others for the things that we do. In Romans chapter 2, verse 6, it says that God will give to each person according to what he has done. And I think God is certainly capable of understanding that people may be told to do things that are under duress, or they put trust in people and end up doing something bad. So I think there's some grace there. But, you know, once you become aware that maybe I should be thinking more about what I'm doing instead of just doing what somebody says because they said to do it, I think God's going to start saying, yeah, you need to do that. You need to have more responsibility for what you're doing. You just can't dump it off on an authority. And you can't give people more authority than they really ought to have scripturally. And again, in James chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, not many of you should presume to be teachers, my brothers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. Authority is a very, very dangerous concept. And some people, they go to the well of authority to make things happen. And they find out that, wow, authority, I tell people to do things and they do it. Wow, this is great. And they just think that the whole church becomes this command and control operation. They tell people to do things, people do things, and stuff gets done, and they're all happy about it. But, you know, the problem is, what if this is out of control? What if people aren't doing what they should be doing for the right reasons? What if they aren't exercising the judgment they ought to be exercising? And what if they should be doing something a little bit different or completely different than what they're being told to do by the authority? And again, as I mentioned before, you know, authority and example are two of the emptiest reasons to do anything. And I personally think that, you know, a reason to do something would be because something is good, or because something is right, or it's the best option at the time. Those are the kind of reasons that you should be doing things, not because someone told you to do it and they're an authority. Authoritarianism, like I was saying, you know, it brings a short-term success, but it can bring a lot of problems. And, you know, one of the other things that plays into that, another problem, is that people grow through succeeding and failing. You know, look at your life. There are times that you've succeeded and learned from it, and there's times that you failed and learned from it. And chances are you learn more from failing than you do from succeeding. And the process is part of the result. And authoritarian type situations, authoritarian type leaders don't seem to really recognize that. The process is part of the result. And when you use authority too much, you can hinder individual development and increase dependency. For instance, consider parenting. Now, you can tell your kids what to do like they're 2 years old all the way through their teenage years. Now, most of them, you know, are going to have a brain and start objecting to that a lot earlier than when they're teenagers. But imagine if you told them to do things all the time, and the only time they could do something is when you told them to do it. They would be completely dependent upon you. They wouldn't grow. They wouldn't mature. They would be stunted in their growth. Now, to some church leaders, the idea that people would do what they tell them to do is like a dream come true. To them, that model is like, wow, this is excellent. I tell people to do things and they do it. We've got such a great church. I think that's a terrible church, because you have a whole body full of people that need to be thinking and doing things and maturing and growing and learning. And if you have people that are completely dependent upon this whole idea of authority, then how are they going to grow? It's really warped. And yet, people that have bought into the question of authoritarianism, as far as they're concerned, it's the best thing going. And they usually think that until it blows up in some of these kind of cases. And again, remember, the scriptures talk about people being discipled or becoming disciples. A disciple is a learner. Making disciples means teaching and not controlling. You don't see Jesus going around being authoritarian with people. He let people do things right. He let them do things wrong. He let them choose to follow or not. And honestly, the blessing of righteousness and the blessing of a relationship with God comes because of what's inside of you and what you choose to do, not what somebody makes you do or coerces you to do. And you just don't see that kind of leadership from Jesus or from the leaders in the early church. You just don't see it. If God is willing to let people make mistakes and go on a process of learning and growth, then why shouldn't churches? Why shouldn't people? Well, they get addicted to this whole thing about authority and making things happen, and they get flattered into thinking that that's the way that everything should be, and again, it's just not. So let's move on to one more topic here, and the whole question of thought reform. And you might hear the phrase brainwashing used at times. And there are sometimes you'll see behavior, or you'll see a church, or maybe you've been in a church where you just go, this is nuts, this is brainwashing, this is a cult. They're engaging in thought reform here. And I want to talk about this a little bit because there is something to it. And a little education will go a long way with us here. Probably the most significant work on this question that I've seen, been aware of, is a book named The Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism by Robert Lifton. And Lifton is a psychiatrist, and he studied people that had been exposed to thought reform camps in China after the Chinese Revolution in the late 40s and early 50s. And these people had managed to get out of China and had come to Hong Kong, and he was able to make contact with them and began interviewing them and seeing them over a period of time and learning about what they had been exposed to and the effects that it had had. And his book is very very heady, so it's not the easiest read you'll ever have, but he really goes through a very thorough discussion of the thing. Well, what he found is that there were 8 main keys to a thought reform environment, number one. This is where it starts. The first key was what he called milieu control. Control of the environment, control of communications, that kind of thing. The second one, mystical manipulation, is what he called it. And it was the orchestrated provoking of emotions and behaviors. And the reason he called it mystical is because the subject thinks it's magic. They don't understand that they're being manipulated, but the people doing the manipulating know they are doing the manipulating. The third characteristic is the demand for purity and the idea that there's perfection is defined by the environment and that perfection must be attained. The fourth key, and he called this the cult of confession, that people were in need of confessing their shortcomings to this demand for purity. And it's interesting, he used the phrase, confession of crimes not committed in pursuit of an arbitrary cure. The cure was that you had confessed. You didn't really have to change, you just had to confess that you fell short of the purity that was demanded. The fifth characteristic was what Lifton called the sacred science, the ultimate moral vision for mankind, this all-encompassing great truth that the environment expects to inflict upon the world or provide for the world. This is how the world should be, and it's their view of the truth, and they hold to it as though it was sacred, but that it's also a science, so it's above question. And you simply have to accept it, or you will be forced to accept it. The sixth characteristic was what Lifton called loading the language with thought-terminating cliches. And so when complex issues would arise, there would be a thought-terminating cliché to answer it. For instance, in the Chinese situation, a lot of times the offenses that people would commit were the crimes against the people. And the phrase would be used, well, that's a crime against the people. And the cliché pigeonholes the behavior and condemns it all at the same time. And so it really doesn't allow for a more extensive analysis. It's just pigeonholed and condemned through this loaded language. The seventh characteristic is what Lifton called doctrine over person, that the doctrine is more real or valid than human experience. And so that if the doctrine wasn't working for you, it was your fault. You weren't doing it right somehow. It was your problem, because there's nothing wrong with the doctrine. Of course, the doctrine that they're teaching was that, it's perfect, and this is the ultimate vision for the world. So who are you to question it? So if your experience doesn't match up with the doctrine, well, it's your problem. It's not the doctrine's problem. And then the last characteristic or last trait that Lifton identified was the dispensing of existence of those who don't reform. So the only people that really exist are the ones who conform and conform to the sacred science. If you don't reform or conform to the sacred science, then you don't really deserve to exist. You're not worthy of existence. And you put these things together, and of course I can't summarize the whole experience and all the things that Lifton talked about in a short class like this, but the point is that you study these things out, and these are the things that were done with the environment that got people to engage in thought reform and to be subject to it. And if you think about these in a church setting, controlling the environment, I've seen this practice where you have frequent meetings, a very busy schedule, wearing people down, even things like controlling the lights and the volume, maybe early morning meetings, late night meetings, again, controlling the environment, controlling what people do to the extent that they really are out of control of what they do. You have to be at all these meetings. You have to be at this event, or if somebody wants to schedule a time with you, you have to do it. And you lose control of your own life and your own environment because somebody else is controlling it. And it's a key trait to thought reform. And again, the whole question of mystical manipulation, one of the most common things that I've seen done with this is people may confide confidential information to other people. And then that information is shared, and it might reappear again in a sermon or something. Some of you out here, you went out and got drunk last night. Wow, he's talking about me. Well, yeah, because you told somebody and that person told the preacher. And there's nothing mystical about it, but it looks that way. Wow, he must really know me. Well, if you're in a room large enough, you can talk about almost anything that somebody probably has done recently too. So you got to be careful with that, but it gives people the feeling that these people really know something, and it plays on your emotions, and it draws you into this control. The whole demand for purity question, one of the things Lifton talks about that's really a brilliant observation is that the trump card of any thought reform environment is exploiting people's what he called existential guilt. The fact that you fall short, you're human, you fall short. A clever manipulator will always hammer on guilt to get you to do something. By making you guilty, by demonstrating your guilt, they will use that to say, well, because you're guilty, you should do this. Because you're guilty, you should do that. And of course, it's a non sequitur. Those two things don't follow. You may be guilty of any number of things. Doesn't mean that you should do anything about those. And again, now I think there are some things that you should do. If you've sinned in a scriptural sort of sense, you should repent in a scriptural sort of a sense. But again, you've got to consider these things with some thought. You just can't allow yourself to be manipulated because of guilt. Because it doesn't take any great gift to point out guilt in people. Somebody who's always pointing out failures and guilt, it looks like a real genius for a little while, but then you come to figure out, it's not that hard to point out other people's failings. And it's funny, people that engage in this, when someone points out their failings, well, now you're critical, and who are you to question, And that's the whole thing about the sacred science, I'm right and you're wrong. The cult of confession is interesting here. The way that you satisfy this existential guilt is to confess. Oh, I was wrong. I'm a sinner. I don't deserve. And you'll hear things in these kind of environments that are really kind of bizarre. They're warps. Like, oh, I don't deserve to be a member of this church, or wow, I don't deserve to have you as a friend, or I don't deserve to be saved, or I don't deserve anything. You know, and yeah, in one sense, we're somewhat unworthy of God's love or care, but you know, at the same time, He also made us and He does love us. And I don't think you find too many places in the Scripture where this idea of our total debasement is mentioned. I mean, the reason God loves us is because we are worthy of that love. Otherwise, He would be an irrational God. And so you just can't take these things to this extreme where everybody is just guilty, 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 and don't deserve things, and pay this lip service to these kind of statements and things like that. And one thing that you'll see in these kind of environments, too, is that people really don't have to change. All they have to do is say the right things. And it's funny, as I'm recording this today, Tiger Woods just came out and had his public statement and apologizing to people for the things that he had done and whatnot. And rightfully so, at least, he said, you know, the real apology is not what he says, but it's what he does. And there's a lot of truth to that. Celebrities that get in trouble, they'll apologize. But do they really change? Or do they just work on not getting caught anymore? And talk is so cheap, and everybody seems to put so much stock in apologies. You need to apologize for that. You need to apologize for this. Apologize, apologize. Well, how about just change? And it just has gotten kind of ridiculous where if you say the wrong thing or something, you have to apologize for it. Our whole culture has gotten whacked out on this idea of confession, and it's taken on a life that's far more significant than it really ought to have. Yeah, confession's important if you do something wrong, but it's more important to change. If you confess and don't change, well, what good was the confession? But of course, with these demands for purity, you never will be able to attain it, so you will always be confessing. And that's kind of the irony of this. It keeps you guilty all the time, and so you're always in need of confession. This whole question of loading the language with thought-terminating cliches, I've seen this put in place in churches where you'll see this phrase, well, just be a disciple. Just be a disciple. That answers all questions. Just be a disciple. Well, I need to buy a new car, and you know, should I get this one or should I get that one? Well, just be a disciple. What would a disciple do? Thanks a lot. You know, what does that have to do with anything? Another label that might be used or a cliche, well, so-and-so is bitter. They're a fall away. Or so-and-so is a leader. Or so-and-so is sharp. Or so-and-so is godly. And these words take on a meaning that is more than just the simple meaning that most people would give them. There's a whole culture and an idea behind it. On one discussion group, I remember seeing some of these words used with a little TM afterwards, recognizing that it's a cliche, that it means more than just the sum of the words, that there's a whole secret meaning to it, so to speak. And again, the question of doctrine over person, I've seen this applied in bad church settings where if it doesn't work for you, it's because you're not doing it right. Well, if you're being a disciple and things aren't working out in your life, it's because you're not being a good enough disciple. You need to be a better disciple. You need to be a better disciple. You need to be a better disciple. And maybe life is a little more complex than that. Or maybe this idea about being a disciple isn't the be-all, end-all that it's being presented as. Well, that's the question. But again, you'll see this idea of doctrine over person advanced in an unhealthy thought reform type of environment. And the question of dispensing of existence, you'll see that the failure stories don't get told. Only the success stories get told. And people that don't conform or people that leave, they just don't count. And it's amazing. Someone may be you know, the leader of a ministry, then they leave the movement, and all of a sudden, their whole role in existence just is written out of history. It's really amazing. Someone leaves the church, well, they're gone, bye. They don't exist anymore. And it's really bizarre. Now, the question of thought reform, and this is something that merits discussion as well. Does it really work? Does thought reform work? Can you take someone, subject them to some set of stimulus, and change how they think? And Lifton really had a vested interest in this question. And what he found is that thought reform could work as long as you keep it up, as long as you keep people in that setting and in that environment and apply these stimulus to them. You can get them to conform. You can get their behavior to conform. You can get them to confess. But the thing that Lifton also found is once people were out of that environment, away from all those various stimuli, it wouldn't work unless the person wanted it to work. So there were people he interviewed that became very loyal to the whole Chinese Communist Revolution, even after they left the environment, but it was because they wanted it to work. There were people that got out of there that didn't want this thought reform to work, and they were able to put the pieces of their life back together and get their mind back together. So thought reform doesn't really work unless you continually apply it to people. Now, unfortunately, that means that if someone's in this kind of an environment, they can be subjected to it, and it can be very hard for them to break out of it. And that raises another question. You know, the Chinese put people into prisons, and they call them re-education camps. But how does church make a thought reform environment work? I mean, people aren't in jail. They aren't locked up. How do they make them be a part of it? And the way that it's done, and I don't know all the ways. I'm sure there's many other ways. But at least one way that it's done is that they can claim that they have the only plan that works, or they have the exclusive key to salvation, or they, somehow, they make themselves unique. We are the only one that has what you want. And as long as the follower thinks that, then they may as well be in jail. If they really think that this church or this leader or this movement is the only one, the only option for the things that matter to me, then that leadership can do whatever it wants. And again, let's go to the question of truth. Is that claim of uniqueness really true? Is this one church or this one leader or this one movement the only way to be saved, the only plan that works? Are they really the only godly people left in the world? That kind of thing. The only people who are doing all the right things the right way. And a controlling thought reform sort of a church, they will be reminding you constantly that they are the only ones that do things the right way. That's like a red warning sign right there. Well, let's look at it, though, from kind of a more of a generic Christian sort of point of view. Because if you look at these criteria, there are aspects of each of them that I think can be incorporated into faithful Christian living. And so it could be kind of confusing because Christians may have meetings that they go to. Services could be tightly controlled and packaged. Everybody is a sinner. We do consider Christianity to be the truth. And so a lot of these things that Lifton pointed out may have some sort of an implication in Christianity that I think is legitimate. And to make things worse, if you want to conform to the group that you're a part of, you may not care how that group gets you there. I remember when I was in a very controlling church that I wanted to be reconstructed. That's what they called it. They actually called it that. I wanted to be reconstructed. Make me conform. Make me better. And, you know, even in Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, listen to what Paul says. Don't conform any longer to the pattern of the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. And so you could even point to that and say, well, see, God wants you to be brainwashed. He wants you to have thought reform. He wants your mind to be renewed. But the problem that you have with these thought reform controlling type environments is that everything that happens is contrived. It's not really a transformation. It's a control and a manipulation. when you remove the stimulus, the behavior goes away. And in these churches, you'll see this over and over and over again. When the leadership goes away, when the accountability or the riding herd on people goes away, the behavior that they were trying to cause also goes away. It's because people were not transformed. And the scriptures really instruct us that all these rules and stuff really don't change people. And that's the lesson that really Christians ought to learn from this. Look in Colossians 2 and verse 20. Since you died with Christ to the basic principles of this world, why, as though you still belong to it, do you submit to its rules? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. These are all destined to perish with use because they are based on human commands and teachings. Such regulations indeed have an appearance of wisdom with their self-imposed worship, their false humility, and their harsh treatment of the body, but they lack any value in restraining sensual indulgence. Now, what Paul's talking about in all likelihood in Colossians 2 here is Gnosticism. And Gnosticism had this, among other things, this extensive bunch of rules about how you had to behave. And Paul was saying, you know, these rules, they look like they're wise. There's all this this apparent humility, but it's false humility, and the harsh treatment of the body. But he says they lack any value in restraining sensual indulgence. They lack value in really changing who you are. And that's the problem with a thought reform environment in a church, and even a very controlling sort of church. A church can be very controlling, and you can get addicted to the whole authority, control, I'm going to tell people what to do, and they're going to do it while this is great. Does it really change people? And this is being seen over and over and over again in so many different environments. Everything from youth ministries that are very tightly controlled and everything. When people leave the youth ministry, they have no basis for their faith anymore because it didn't change them. It didn't really connect them with God. It just forced them to do a bunch of behavior things. And again, if you look in the New Testament, you can see that the early church did not use thought reform techniques. Look at the big picture. Don't try to warp individual incidents. People that are big on thought reform might try to take an incident here or an incident there and say, oh, see, Jesus did this or the apostles did this. Yeah, Jesus called Peter Satan one time. You know, I've heard that preached on, and see, he got on his case, and he was the leader of the apostles. He had to challenge him because he was wrong. Well, you know, that was one time. And I think there was a bigger picture of that. And frankly, Satan may have been a part of that in ways that may not be apparent to people that preach on that lesson or preach on that story. When you look at the big picture of the New Testament and the balance, you do not see thought reform behavior exercised upon Christians. So, again, to wrap this up, what do you look out for? Watch out for claims of uniqueness. That's the red flag. When you see that, look out. Watch out for how the non-conforming people are treated. Are they of value? Are they valid? Do they deserve to exist? Or is there intolerance towards them? Are they written out of existence? That sort of thing. And again, look at the environment. Is it making you conform or letting you conform? Training you to conform? Or teaching you how to train yourself to be godly? Like Paul told Timothy, train yourself to be godly. You don't get training in godliness by being bossed around and controlled. You get it by training yourself, you know? And it's right there in the scriptures, and yet there's all these different groups that practice all this control type stuff, and you just have to watch out for it. So watch out for the red flags. If you see that, question the claims of uniqueness. Question whether it really works long term. And again, you'll see that it won't. Well, before we wrap up this whole question of persuasion, because we've looked at persuasion from a compliance professional point of view, from a group point of view, with respect to authority, and also with respect to a thought reform environment, it really brings up the question, why be persuaded? Where does persuasion really fit in the life of someone who wants to be a faithful Christian? And it's a great question. And a couple years ago, I ran across a book that I was really thinking about this whole question of freedom and versus persuasion, and ran across a book by Eric Fromm entitled Escape from Freedom. And it's, again, it's one of those heady books. It's kind of like Lifton's book, so it's not an easy read. But his whole approach and question he was addressing is that why do people pursue freedom, and then once they give it up, or they get freedom, they give it up? Because that's the name of the book, Escape from Freedom. Why do people attain freedom and then relinquish it? And it was very perplexing to him. So he set out to study this and investigate it. And let me give you some of the points that he raised, and I'll just present these to you and let you think about them and think, is this really true? Is this what's going on with that? His point was that true freedom to think and decide and to act is a heavy burden. Freedom brings anxiety. It brings uncertainty. It brings discomfort. But lack of freedom brings certainty. It brings comfort. It brings acceptance. And so psychologically, freedom is a tough thing. Lack of freedom is an easy thing. Psychologically, because you don't have any responsibility anymore. You just exist. You don't have to make decisions. You don't have to think. Now, he identified that there's two main ways to give up freedom. And the one would be to give it up to an authoritarian leader that you must obey. And again, this echoes right into everything else we've been talking about in this class. The other way that you can give up your freedom is to a group that you must imitate or conform to. So either you've got the individual or group, but you give up your freedom to one or the other. And the paradox here is that people long for freedom, but then they give it up when they get it. But the question I want to ask you and really raise in response to this, is this really faithful living? In Galatians chapter 5 and verse 1, Paul says, "It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery." Now, the slavery that he was talking about there was conformance to the law of Moses. And in context, Paul is saying, look, that this whole thing is gone. It's been put away. We've been set free from that. Don't let yourself be burdened by it again. But again, here's an example where the people were exposed to this idea of law, and the gospel comes along and says, no, you're free. You're free from that. And yet the people felt a pull to relinquish their freedom back to a law. And freedom is a marvelous, incredible gift that God has given to us. We're free to do good things. We're free to love. And later on, Galatians 5 talks about how, you know, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law. We're free to do good. We're free to have our cup be half full instead of half empty all the time. We're free to do good, and the good things count as something good, instead of doing good things and have somebody come around and say, well, it wasn't good enough. When you're free, it is a burden, but it's part of being an individual to be free. God allows you, with all the resources that you have, to do the good things that you see fit to do. That's freedom. And it's between you and God. And there's a place for leaders. There's a place for the church. There's a place for groups. But ultimately, you're free to do the good things without just being controlled or made to conform to other groups. And so freedom is a tough burden. And honestly, do churches teach people how to be free? Do they teach them the process of becoming free and what to do with that freedom? Or do they want to latch on and control? Oh, you've got too much freedom. And, you know, there are times in churches where I've heard people talk about, well, we're free in Christ. Yeah, but you're not free to sin. well, who's talking about freedom to sin? Well, is that what you want to do? And they almost look at anything where someone might exercise freedom as a sin. You need to conform. You need to be controlled. And of course, it's because they're invested in being controlled or doing the controlling. And they maybe haven't been able to wrestle successfully with the question of freedom. And so they've given up their freedom to something else, and they want you to give your freedom up as well. So in wrapping this up, you know, there's a lot of ways to be persuaded. And persuasion isn't a bad thing. I mean, we've been persuaded about many good things in our lives. We can all look at things and say, oh, I'm glad somebody persuaded me about this. I'm glad somebody persuaded me about that. So it doesn't mean that it's a bad thing. But the problem is, in our bad church experiences, there's been some bad persuasion as well. And so what you've got to do with that bad experience is look at the important times when you were persuaded to do things, whether they were good or bad. And look at both. Get a balanced perspective of it and say, okay, was that good persuasion or was that bad persuasion? And allow yourself to be educated about, well, that wasn't good, or that was good, or that was okay, that wasn't okay. And by doing that, you do a couple things. Number one, you really come to a better sense of understanding of your past, and you'll have a better sense of peace about it. Also, in doing that, you educate yourself for your future and for your present and for the lives of those around you, the people that you can persuade to consider these things. And again, when you persuade, use healthy persuasion. You've got to give people the freedom to not be persuaded. That's part of the process, too. You got to look at your own motives. What's in this for me? Do I feel better about myself when I persuade somebody to do something? I mean, of course you do. Of course you do. And yet you have to give them the freedom to accept or reject your persuasion, because that's part of the process God has for them, too. And hopefully discussing these things, and you know, you may want to get some of the books we've referenced, discussing things like this, it helps you understand your past, it equips you for your present and your future, and it also equips the people around you. So anyway, thanks for your attention, and I'll talk to you next time.